Welcome everybody. We've got a very interesting discussion ahead of us this afternoon. But before that, I could just announce that tomorrow morning in our busy, crammed programme, we are meeting again in this room at 10:30 for another seminar which will last until 11:45 with Lord Ryan Leighton, who's with us here today, who's the Vice Chairman of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and Eric Schlosser, who's a journalist and author of Command and Control. And they will be speaking on nuclear weapons and 21st century threats, implications for safety and security. If you'd like to come to that, can you let Jackie and Jakes know on your way out so we can make provision for whatever the numbers are. But this afternoon we have a very interesting session given everything else that's happening in the world at the moment, which is entitled Europe and the World Towards a More Effective EU Foreign and Security Strategy. Now, that's not a title thought up by me. That is the title of a report which we're going to discuss this afternoon, which was produced by the House of Lords EU External Affairs Subcommittee, chaired by Christopher Tugendhat, who's here to launch this discussion this afternoon. The format will be, for those of you who've been to our seminars before, the same as usual. We'll start with four presentations from Lord Tugendhat, Christopher Tugendhat, who, as I say, is the chairman of the House of Lords EU External Affairs Subcommittee. Lord Risby, Richard Risby, who is a member of the House of Lords EU External Affairs Subcommittee as well. Dr. Stirrup, Lord Stirrup, who is also a member of that committee, and as is Baroness Sutty, who is sitting on my left. And I'll call them in that order. I'll ask Christopher to first of all introduce the subject. He'll speak to us for about 15 minutes, and then each of the others for about 10. And then, as is my normal practice, I will open it up to questions and answers and comments, because to me that is almost the most important part of these occasions, when you have a chance to react to what you've heard and also to put forward your own views. If I may say, when that happens, I will call you if you've signalled me, and if you could please introduce yourselves. And I don't know whether we've got a roving mic, but we have. If we hadn't, I would say face backwards rather than forward, so people at the back can hear your questions. But if you've got a roving mic, that's not necessary. But I'll explain that again when we get there. But first of all, we go straight into this discussion, which is, as I say, entitled Europe and the World Towards a More Effective EU Foreign and Security Strategy. And I'll start by asking Christopher Tugendhat to speak to us.
Well, Michael, first of all, I'd like to thank you and the forum for inviting us to give our views on this occasion. We were talking just a few moments ago about when you told me about your plans for setting up the forum, and it's hard to believe that that was 10 years ago, and I admire very greatly, as do my colleagues, the contribution which the Global Strategy Forum has made and continues to make to the foreign policy debate in this country. And we're very pleased to have the opportunity to contribute to it in this way. Now, inevitably, our report has been caught up in the referendum debate, and I make no complaints about that. Indeed, in the course of my speech, as in the course of the report, I will have a word or two to say about Brexit. But the genesis of the report lies way beyond the debate in this country, and it is aimed at a broader audience than this country. As many people here probably know, the High Representative, Mrs. Mogherini, Federica Mogherini, is in the process of preparing a new EU strategy on foreign and security policy, which is due to be presented to the Council in June. This is quite a historic moment because the last one was, I think, as long ago as 2003, and the world has changed a good deal since then. And our purpose in undertaking this report is to feed in to the Mogherini process and to try to influence the High Representative's thoughts before she actually enunciates them. And I would point out in passing that I think this is a very good practical way in which a national parliament, or at least one chamber of the British National Parliament, does seek to influence EU policy as well as the policy of its own government. And I think that in some ways the British House of Commons and British House of Lords are particularly active in this way. The point we make absolutely clear at the outset of the report and our point of departure is that foreign policy is the responsibility of the member states and should remain so, and indeed nobody suggests, I think, otherwise. But what we want is for the European Union to provide the member states with an overarching framework within which they can act collectively and more effectively than in the past. I emphasize that this doesn't necessarily mean all acting together at the same time. We, in fact, say that we think one of the most effective ways in which the European Union can bring influence to bear is through ad hoc groups, small groups of member states acting on behalf of the whole Union, and that this is often more conducive to rapid and decisive action. And I think perhaps a very good example of that is the E3+3 exercise in relation to Iran. The challenge is to ensure that the EU has the means to ensure that these ad hoc groups become and remain representative of an accepted EU position. And in order to ensure that the group of member states is representative of the whole, it is very important that the High Representative should be involved in whatever is happening. And indeed, of course, in the case of Iran, Cathy Ashton played a very prominent role. And I think that's a good example of an exercise that has worked well. The importance of ensuring that however many or however few member states are involved, they are operating on the basis of an agreed EU position, is not simply theology. It arises from the fact that although foreign policy is a member state responsibility, it is often executed by EU institutions and through EU instruments. Obviously, the sanctions on Iran, the sanctions on Russia, are an example of the member states actually implementing their decisions by means of EU instruments. And it doesn't, I mean, those are two very obvious and high-profile examples, but they're by no means unique. The same applies to development and trade agreements for countries which the EU wishes to support. One being negotiated at the present time concerns Tunisia. And then there's the negotiations over the continuation of the waiver on Jordan's export subsidy program provides another example. And financial assistance to the Ukraine is a third. So it is important to bear in mind that although the member states are taking decisions as sovereign countries, the way in which they execute and implement is very often through the instruments of the European Union, which of course brings me to Brexit. If the British people decide that we should leave the European Union, everybody, I think, recognises that will lead to a major upheaval in our relations with our partners. I mean, it would be a massive decision. It could hardly be otherwise. And it is hard to believe that an upheaval in concerning our EU partners would leave the close cooperation which at present exists in relation to foreign policy unaffected. No doubt, if the spirit was willing, we and they could still align our actions, and no doubt too, we could still align the way in which the implementation took place. But aligning one's position with the group, with the EU, is clearly a more complicated business than being part of the decision within the EU, and aligning the implements for execution, again, is clearly more time-consuming and more difficult than if we have been part of the decision-making process as to what those instruments should actually be. And indeed, if we're not part of the decision-making process, it might be that we don't agree with what the others decide, and that therefore it would be, in any case, more difficult to present a common front. So that is, I think, one of the implications. Now, I also conclude that quite apart from whether Britain remains in or outside the European Union, that the most direct challenges to the security and stability of the European Union and to its member states and to the citizens of those member states originate in our neighbourhood, and that that is where the EU's efforts and the efforts of the member states should in the first instance be concentrated. And I recall in particular in the report for the relationship with Turkey to be put on to a new and more sustainable footing. And we criticised quite strongly the way in which the EU allowed the relationship with Turkey to get into disarray, putting the accession negotiations onto the back burner and not finding some other valid alternative to carry the relationship forward. Well, now, that was on February the 16th, and obviously the relationship with Turkey has moved forward quite sharply, and I would suggest that it emphasizes the urgency that we attached to it, and the need to establish a relationship with this very important partner country, starting from first principles. Now, speaking for myself, and I emphasize that this is my own point of view, it was not a point of view which we discussed in our deliberations, it's not a point of view which features in our conclusions, but personally, I believe that the relationship with Turkey should be on the basis of a close association rather than on the basis of membership. But whatever it is, we do need to be clear about what it is, and the recent events underline that, and so does the extremely disorganized way in which the Union is going about trying to put the relationship onto a better footing, with Mrs. Merkel playing I don't know whether on the outside left or the outside right, but certainly not down the middle with the rest of her partners. We also have something to say on relations with our other neighbours as well. We say in relation to the Eastern Partnership countries, that is places like Armenia and Georgia and so forth, that in the absence of a realistic timetable for entry, and I really don't believe that it is possible to have a realistic timetable for entry with those countries, but in its absence, the EU needs to define its objectives and interests and to communicate these clearly to the countries concerned. We must be careful not to avoid building up unrealistic expectations in those countries about what the European Union is able to deliver. And also, I refer back to a report which the committee produced a year ago in relation to Ukraine, when we said that in dealing with these countries, it is necessary to take account of Russian interests, that Russia mustn't have a veto on those countries, we said, but equally you can't have a systematic development program that benefits those countries if they are in absolute loggerheads with Russia, because Russia's capacity to screw the whole thing up would obviously be very great. And so far as Russia itself is concerned, we emphasize the need to continue to stand up to its breaches of international law, but also to remain open to cooperation and dialogue in areas of common interest. Now, obviously, the areas of common interest with Russia are very considerable, most notably in Syria. It takes two sides to have a discussion, and at the moment, the Russians seem to be not falling over themselves to do that. But so far as we are concerned, our view is that while standing up to Russia in Ukraine and elsewhere, we must always be ready to discuss areas of common interest with Russia. We also want to strengthen EU and NATO deterrence in the Baltic states and in the Black Sea. Against this background, we call for better cooperation between the EU and NATO. Now, the irony is, of course, that the members of the EU and NATO have a very considerable overlap. Not every member of NATO is a member of the EU, not every member of the EU is a member of NATO, but the biggest and most important countries are members of both, and I hope that continues to be the case. And also, there is obviously a considerable overlap. And yet, we have observed, and Lord Stirrup knows much more about this than I do, that individual member states often have rather different postures when they are talking in a NATO context from what they have when they are talking in an EU context. And that does make coordination between the activities of the two organizations sometimes rather difficult. And finally, I should just like very briefly to return to the Middle East, that all of us are aware that Europe, not just the EU, but Europe, is facing this huge challenge of the migrant crisis. I don't think any population movement has been comparable in the lifetimes of most people here, unless it's perhaps the short-term movement of refugees in the period between 1945 and 1947. But it seems at times that half the Middle East and half of Africa and much of the Balkans has suddenly got up and is on the move, and that this is a crisis of the most enormous dimensions. Now, this was not something which we were dealing with in our report. It's not something that I can deal with now, but I think it does emphasize the recommendation in our report that the EU, in dealing with the Middle East, should focus on the linked issues of economic reform and good governance in the political, judicial, and security sectors. So that is by way of an introduction. My colleagues will now enlarge on what I have said.
Well, Michael, can I add my thanks to you for this event, but also for what you do so comprehensively to look at so many areas of huge interest in the world, and particularly Jacqueline, who actually makes this always a pleasure to attend and is so well organized. If we look at current EU foreign and security strategy at the moment, it is currently pretty daunting, because policy has demonstrably become overwhelmingly reactive due to the twin factors of tensions initially arising out of the Eurozone crisis and the very diverse economic performance of the member states, and also now the all-consuming migrant crisis. These two factors have above all highlighted deep European divisions. Therefore, the background to the current period of reflection of foreign and security policy is being impacted by a mixture of violence and warfare in the Middle East, as well as a global recalibration arising out of the fall in commodity prices, with the potential for social disorder amongst our neighbours. And I echo what Christopher said. If we take Turkey first, the current dialogue between the EU and Turkey has, of course, been dramatically brought to life by the immense migratory flows and huge pressures on Turkey, both financially and in the area of their own national security. This in part is because of a lack of strategic collective foresight on the part of the EU for many years in respect of Turkey, and I hope that this report will do something to address this. In the past, the EU required Turkey to fulfil the comprehensive Copenhagen criteria for membership, whilst in effect declining to offer a final goal of actual EU membership, however defined. To the credit of the United Kingdom, Turkey, it was felt here, should have been offered a much more flexible trajectory, and that was indeed acceptable to the Turks as well at that time. Now the relationship with Turkey is under spotlight in an emergency situation, and as our report sets out, a relationship based upon first principles is now required. So, let this be a strategic restart button period, even if the start has been so controversial and indeed unpromising. Similarly, Russia has now clearly marked itself out as a neighbouring power of real will and influence, and whilst resisting their aggression and the testing of EU members' boundaries, finding a way ultimately to offer greater market access to Russia is one of the possible ways to enter potentially more rewarding dialogue, which could assist in bringing calm to Ukraine, which cries out for economic and political stability. Undoubtedly, the most potent weapon to effect EU influence is access to the single market, and to share the benefits of this access and of economic success. That is the positive side. Equally, on the negative side, sanctions against Russia and Iran have undoubtedly greatly impacted these two countries, but have helped to bring Russia and Iran to the negotiating table. Both are fundamentally important assets that the EU can bring to bear. Now, the EU is based upon firm democratic principles, and whilst we cannot expect our neighbours to pursue parallel policies, we can deploy our influence and our economic might to encourage good governance and judicial and social reform. In other words, to develop a foreign and security policy for our wider neighbourhood, which is clearly recommended in the report. But given the differing viewpoints, geographical locations and capabilities of different member states, the report encourages the use of ad hoc national groupings within the context of this overall report which has been written. France and Germany, especially the latter, led the engagement with Ukraine and Russia to resolve the difficulties bilaterally, and that is did not meet with great success, but the efforts were clearly there. Equally, whilst there is no suggestion that there should be any European military structure separate from NATO, the United Kingdom and France are the two main European powers who can best deploy direct or indirect military activity and assistance in common pursuits. NATO finds it more difficult to coordinate with the EU issues due to, for example, issues over Turkey and Cyprus, but encouraging the two organisations to cooperate is good. But of course, some states are non-NATO members, so this could never be a perfect solution. In this context, the role of the member state is underlined. There is already considerable contact, which is very welcome, between the High Representative and member states' parliaments, which can assist in identifying areas either in most need of attention or which could lead to the most propitious results. This process needs to continue during and after the period of reflection, as we have commented. I hope, therefore, that it may be possible also to adjust current EU thinking on development aid, which is currently spent substantially on its near abroad and potential accession states. In the United Kingdom, for example, there has been a move to favour fragile states, which could become security risks. And the reason why I say this is because, indeed, these countries are now sources of substantial migratory flows in Europe itself. Ultimately, through the reality of events currently in play across the European continent, I hope that out of the tensions with Turkey, more variegated relationships can be fully accepted between European countries, away from past notions of either full membership or a clearly marked path to full and comprehensive membership. We have seen the impact, for example, of Romanian accession to the EU, causing immense problems in Moldova. But under the umbrella of an effective foreign and security policy, and in view of what we have seen in the advantage of ad hoc groupings, I hope personally that more flexible arrangements can be pursued with some of our European neighbours who may not wish or never wish to join the EU in full membership status. This report suggests
a comprehensive follow-up with a national member parliament. In reacting to the realities in Europe today, this could offer some new thinking about these matters. Ultimately, however, it will require a political will which will now possibly be more obtainable in the light of the crises which are so dramatically influencing the European Union of late, and challenge a number of its long-standing core underpinnings.
Thank you very much and good afternoon, everybody. Great pleasure to be back here in another Global Strategy Forum event. I'm sure everybody has read and memorized the report, so I don't need to go into any of its details. But you will have noticed, I hope, that it is all about strategy. Now, strategy is about bringing together ends, goals or objectives, ways and means in a coherent and balanced way. So at the one end of the scale, you have realistic and achievable objectives, and then down through the spectrum, you have methods of delivering them, and then the actual means which you use to deliver the objectives. And we've heard already this afternoon a bit about the conclusions that have been drawn about the EU's foreign policy and security objectives and some of the ways in which they might be delivered. And I thought that I would just, in my few minutes, focus a bit more at the other end of the spectrum on the means. Now, international security policy is essentially an exercise in power. We are seeking to persuade other people to do something they would not otherwise do or to stop doing something they would otherwise do. I mean, that's the nub of it. And in order to do that, in order to persuade or dissuade or even compel people, you need power. So it all comes down to that in the end. And I think it's worth recalling, I'm sure everyone here is an avid student of Thucydides, what he had to say in his history of the Peloponnesian War about the Melian Dialogue, when the Athenians, who were at war with the Spartans, sent an embassy to the neutral island of Melos to persuade them to join the Athenian side. And the Melians were not keen on this at all. They didn't want to come in on either side, and they rather resented the pressure that the Athenians were bringing to bear on them. And the Athenians, in response, said to them something that still resonates with us nearly 2,500 years later. They said, "Who are you to tell us what we can and can't do? The strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must." Better not be weak. If history has a lesson to teach us, better not be weak. But of course, strength, power comes in many forms. We have at one end of the spectrum hard powers, we refer to it these days, the specialism of the military, if you like, all the way through various aspects of soft power, down to the other end, and very important that is, to moral authority. And we have to look at the EU and ask ourselves, you know, how well it does across that spectrum. But I think we should also recall that across that spectrum, virtually all power, in the final analysis, relies upon economic strength. Without economic strength, you're going to be very hard pushed to find hard power or soft power that you can exercise effectively in the international arena. So, taking a look at the EU, where does it sit in that particular context? Well, first of all, of course, economically, it's hard-pressed. If you look at the low rates of growth, if you look at the fiscal problems, if you look at the high rates of unemployment, and if you look at the vast disparities across the EU, then clearly, in terms of economic strength, although it's a large organisation with a lot of people and a lot of potential economic power, it can't realise that at the moment. So that is a fundamental drawback in terms of the means necessary for an effective foreign and security policy. In terms of hard power, it also has some significant drawbacks. Chris has already mentioned the difficult relationship between the EU and NATO. There is an arrangement, the Berlin Plus arrangement, which is supposed to enable the EU to have access to NATO capabilities, NATO facilities, NATO command and control, because there is so much overlap between the two institutions and it doesn't make sense to try and duplicate command structures and so forth. We heard, as you will have read in our evidence, that the Berlin Plus arrangements are effectively dead in the water. There are perhaps a number of reasons for this, but I think one of the most fundamental is the difference in culture between the two organisations, and indeed in some ways the difference in purpose. Having sat for 4.5 years on both the NATO Military Committee and the EU Military Committee, I saw this at first hand. NATO is a military organisation. Of course, it has civilian political control, as we all have in our democracies, and so politicians, you know, the foreign secretary level, the defence secretary level, and the head of state, the prime ministerial level, call the shots. But it is essentially an organisation that is about military operations. It's built around a military command structure which everybody understands. That is its fundamental raison d'etre. The EU is totally different. In the EU, military operations are a sideshow. They're a subset. They're a distraction sometimes, and one gets the notion from time to time that they're a bit of a damn nuisance. And that's the way they seem to be viewed within the organisation. So there isn't the same political focus, there isn't the same secretariat focus on military operations in the EU that there is in NATO. Now, this is entirely understandable, given the two separate rationales for the two organisations. But if they are to operate together effectively, and if the EU is to be able to have effective access and effective use of NATO's capabilities, then there has to be some drawing together of those two cultures. There has to be a meeting of minds. So it's not just about wiring diagrams on organisations and committees. It is about a sharing of cultural identity between the two organisations. This, it seems to me, is fundamental if the EU is to have a strong security policy in the future. It goes without saying, of course, but I'm going to say it, that the EU countries do not spend enough on defence. We do better than most others, and even we do not spend enough, despite the last SDSR. But others do very, very much worse. In part, of course, because of their economic difficulties, we can't blame it all on that. They spent too little on defence before the financial and economic crisis. So we can't just rely upon a resurgence of economic health to restore the defence spending of the EU member states to the level where it should be. So that too is a fundamental weakness in the means that the EU has to deliver its foreign and security policy. Clearly the EU is much better in terms of soft power, and we have seen that, in terms of diplomacy, in terms of development, and of course one of the great levers that the EU has had in terms of soft power, in terms of persuading or dissuading people, is actually the prospect of membership or association with the Union. There's a slight problem with that, in that it's a bit of a one-shot weapon. Once you've used it, it's done. The EU, of course, has very little influence over Cyprus and the internal negotiations on Cyprus at the moment. It had a lot more when Cyprus was not in the EU and was an aspirant member. But nevertheless, it is an important tool, and the neighbourhood policy, I think, is an extremely important aspect of that. So there are lots of soft power tools that the EU can use. We've seen them in use with the Iranian nuclear negotiations. We've seen them in the EU's response to Russia's involvement in Ukraine, where the sanctions regime was much more robust, I think, than many people would have expected, and certainly more robust, I think, than President Putin expected. So there's much that it can do in the soft power area, and that is, if you like, where its key expertise lies. But soft power, disconnected from all the other things across the spectrum of power, particularly at the hard end, is not nearly as effective as an approach that is comprehensive across the full spectrum. And then down at the other end, of course, we have the still very important dimension of moral authority, the values to which the EU subscribes and which it holds dear. The EU, like all of us, faces an enormous challenge in this area because values can very often collide with realpolitik. And we see a prime example of it today with the German negotiations with Turkey over the migrant crisis. Turkey seems to have a very tenuous grip on the rule of law at the moment. Turkey seems to be under the whim of Erdogan rather than under the rule of law. This is not something that we in the EU find particularly palatable, and nor should we. But there is a very pressing migrant crisis, and there is a need, particularly in Germany, to find some sort of solution. So balancing the values that we subscribe to in the EU against the pressing urgency of current crises is always going to be a challenge. And I don't stand here saying that we should always focus solely on values and forget the rest. That would be totally unrealistic. But neither should we forget our values, because they're part of what the EU is, part of what the EU should be, and part of what makes us so attractive to people outside the boundaries of the EU. So, based upon those very personal thoughts of the evidence that we heard and the report that we produced on the basis of that evidence, I would just point to two key areas on which the EU needs to focus if it is to deliver a coherent and achievable foreign and security policy strategy. The first, of course, is to restore the economic vigour of the EU. That, it seems to me, is absolutely fundamental. If we do not achieve that, the rest, frankly, is just going to be so much hot air. And the second is to improve the access to and the use of hard power within the context of an overall EU strategic security approach. That's going to require improved mechanisms, but most importantly, it's going to involve a much greater meeting of minds between the two organisations than we've seen to date. That, of course, is always very difficult to achieve. But again, if we do not achieve it, then in terms of delivering effective security strategy, the EU is going to have one arm tied behind its back. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I would also like to thank Global Strategy Forum for the opportunity to discuss this report. I shall be very brief because an awful lot of the points I might have wanted to make have already been made by my colleagues. I'm planning to just make a few more political points rather than the going into detail of the report. I'm a relative newcomer to the Select Committee process in the House of Lords, and this was my first inquiry that I was involved with. And I have to say I found it a fascinating and extremely positive experience. I worked in the European Parliament for 10 years, and I know that the impact that Select Committee reports can actually have in Brussels. People do take them quite seriously in Brussels, and they're regarded as reports with a lot of expertise which people like to follow. As other colleagues have already said, the foreign policy backdrop has changed significantly since the last strategy review in 2003, and sadly very much not for the better. I think it would be true to say that the EU's foreign security policy has not always met its potential, most notably recently in its lack of a coherent policy towards Russia and Ukraine, and in its current inconsistent policy towards Turkey. And from my own personal experience of working in North Africa and working in Jordan, I would say that the EU offices are of mixed quality, and there is sometimes a real problem with lack of coordination. And so I believe that Mrs. Mogherini's review this summer is an opportunity to provide a framework and prioritise more effectively the EU's foreign policy and foreign policy objectives, not least, as other colleagues have already said, in concentrating on the neighbourhoods, which is where the EU can add real value. I think it's also an opportunity to reinforce and coordinate existing processes, such as the move towards ad hoc groupings, which other colleagues have already spoken about, of member states working together effectively in areas where they have particular interests, expertise and experience. As the Select Committee's report emphasises, it's the member states that will continue to drive foreign and security policy, but the clout of the European Union, when it does work effectively together, should not be underestimated. I remember when I was working in the European Parliament, this was brought very clearly to me when I went on a European Parliament Budgetary Control Committee to Palestine in 2000. I had come from working in the House of Commons, and at that particular time I'd been rather cynical about the power of the European Parliament. But when we went on this Budgetary Control Committee official delegation visit to Palestine, we were looking at how the EU's money had been spent on health and housing projects. I really realised that in the minds of the Palestinian authorities, where the EU is the main budgetary contributor, the EU has a tremendous amount of power, and we do sometimes underestimate quite how much influence and quite how much third countries can look at the European Union as an entity that they take actually rather more seriously than the individual member states, because of the collective power through its extensive budget. I would like to finish on a rather political point, if I may, because although I understand that the Select Committee doesn't actually take a position on these matters, I was very struck during our inquiries visits to Brussels that we asked at virtually every meeting during our day and a half in Brussels, we asked all the various bodies that we met and representatives we met of EU institutions in Brussels whether they felt that the United Kingdom's power, influence had been diminished because of the pending EU referendum. And slightly to our surprise, virtually everybody we spoke to said it really didn't make very much difference. Whether this was out of politeness to us as a delegation or whether it was an actual true assessment of the situation, it's rather hard to tell. But my own personal theory as to why we got that reply is because the influence of the United Kingdom in foreign and security policy is so huge. And I think without the UK's involvement, any future foreign and security policy of the European Union would be very, very significantly diminished. And I think the people that we met in Brussels felt this very strongly, that our role is vital, and I do hope in the forthcoming 4 months of the Brexit debate still to go in this country, I hope that we will concentrate on security matters, foreign policy and security matters, because, to repeat myself, an EU foreign and security policy without the United Kingdom would be hugely, hugely diminished. Thank you.